You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, the bookshop, independent bookshop that I own. And as I'm very proud that we were voted the best bookshop in Philadelphia, and also the best coffee shop as well, for what that's worth. And I wanted to thank all of the listeners and the people who voted for us, and we're very proud of it, as I said. Today we're lucky enough to have with us Matteo Pericoli. Born in Milan, Matteo graduated from the Polytechnic School of Architecture and then moved to New York in 1995. He's written for the New York Times and the New Yorker and the Paris Review, and I think maybe you'll remember I interviewed Sadie Stein, who's the associate editor of that periodical, a couple of weeks ago. In addition, the number of books that Matteo has published is quite interesting and quite visual. Windows on the World is the book we'll be discussing today, but there's also The City Out My Window, Manhattan Unfurled, London for Children, and wonderful children's books, especially one we have in the store, Tommaso and the Missing Line. And I could keep going, The World Unfurled, Manhattan Within. And one of them is a mural that's, I think, 296 feet long in the new International Terminal in New York. Welcome, Matteo. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
So one of the questions I would ask, I know you're an architect, but what is it that you, why is it that you are so entranced with New York City, especially in portraying it and drawing it in such large scale?
This is a very loaded question. it's like asking someone, why are you so taken by your first love? I grew up in Milan, as you said, and my family, my entire family, is from a small area in central Italy, and when I grew up in Milan, I never really understood the meaning of the city I was growing up in. I never really grasped the fact that cities exist beyond the fact that, you know, if more people live next to each other, there are more possibilities of sharing each other's skills and being able to work more rather than having to only to take care of your land. And so I thought that the city was just a very pragmatic fact. When in 95 I moved to New York City, as you said, I realized that cities are almost anything, but that cities have a soul, have a spirit, and having a chance to maybe grow up or encounter a city that is open, is welcoming you, is very inclusive, as New York has truly changed my not only my life but my idea of places. And so I initially was not very aware of what I was looking for, and I was just as you may imagine, it's probably similar with many people who find themselves in a place that they all of a sudden are kind of infatuated with, to say the least. I was trying to impress the city as if it were a person, so I tried to draw everything and tried to draw all of the tops of the buildings, all of the entrances, and trying to make sense of it. On this side of the ocean, we think that cities are a unit, a kind of a organism that can be seen as a whole, with maps from medieval times onward, or from the view on the other side of the hill. And New York was not like that, was not allowing itself to be seen that way. And so I became a little obsessed with it.
Yes, I think you have. Yeah. I think you did. It's like, I'm from Philadelphia. Uh-huh. I've traveled, not, you know, that extensively, but, you know, going to cities like Tokyo or Milan or Rome or London, they are entrancing and beautiful, but there's something about New York, at least in me, that I almost feel like it's the only city. And I don't know why I couldn't explain that to you. It's just something about it that when you're in it, it's just a different type of feeling. And what's interesting about your work is, much like Vladimir Nabokov, is that when you have the perspective that you had, as he did on the English language, sometimes it gives you a better ability to portray the city or the novel, because you have that ability to stand back from it.
But, you know, it's known that the outsiders is a privileged way to look at things. It's basically, you know, there's nothing wrong with being born in a place, but it's double hard to take a distance from some place you know very, very well. And people who have been able to do that have practically achieve something that is almost unachievable. And now that I'm here, today I traveled to Milan, and I'm nearing my 20-year anniversary of leaving the city, and I'm starting to feel that I can actually look at it from an outsider's point of view. So because New York is made of outsiders' point of views, I think it's the most fertile ground for observations, for inward observation, for understanding yourself and understanding yourself within a context. In a city that is 2,000 years old, or it has a solid core that needs to be discovered very slowly, like an onion. You take out one layer after the other, then you may get to something. That is an effort that it has to be done, and if one makes it in a European city or a very old city, you get to something very powerful. But in New York, the core is the outer skin, so you penetrate something right away, and you're part of a system. I remember the first day when I moved to New York in 95, I was almost upset that people were kind of... My level of English was so understandable and clear to many people, who almost spoke as badly or even worse than I did, because I couldn't feel... I expected that I would, they needed to feel like a foreigner for a while. And these are, you know, things that are very banal, and everyone has experienced that. But I think there is probably what I just said is one of the reasons why New York... you can't find it anywhere else, I believe. And from a visual point of view, find yourself in a city that is still in the works, that is not done, that is going to be completed. Once, when I was working on Manhattan Within, I was taking photographs from inside Central Park, and I heard two ladies, they were tourists from somewhere else in America, and the one said to the other, "Imagine how beautiful this city is going to be when it's done." And I had a moment of, my God, this is exactly what I've been feeling all along, that I'm participating in a mechanism that is far from being completed. And so drawing everything from the outside, from the inside, from the windows, it's just a desire of using the outsider's perspective in order to make sense of a place.
It's interesting because last week, coincidentally and very volitionally, I was in New York and I went to the Woolworth Building and looked up and was amazed at how beautiful it was. It's so surprising how many people don't look up. And then I went to the Chrysler Building and saw that they were turning it into a more environmentally sound building, but it was absolutely beautiful. And then my favorite is the Sherry Netherland opposite of the plaza. And then... I guess the Flatiron Building as well. And I looked at them very volitionally. I realized, okay, there's these beautiful buildings in Europe that are completely different and perhaps much nicer and better and way much older, but there's something about these. And then what's interesting about the way you've portrayed New York too is that sometimes it's almost as if you put a compass and the point of the compass was in the middle of Central Park, which is another thing about New York that makes it completely different. And
yeah, it almost makes no sense.
Yeah.
From a European point of view, you cannot leave the city by walking inward. The sense of abandoning something behind you and walking away cannot coincide with the fact that you're walking inward. You're going toward the very center of the island, and it made almost no sense to me, and I needed to try and see what the relationship between outside and inside was. Once I was done with the outside from Central Park, I realized that it was almost and practically the same. And many people whom I saw during my wanderings around the park were almost, getting lost and losing the sense of north and south, or east or west, mostly tourists, of course. But that means that to come up with an idea, 150 years ago, to say we don't have an outskirt of the city, we cannot go the European way by adding layers and layers outside. Let's put, the outside or concentrated inside the middle, basically, of the island was crazy and incredible foresight. And
yes,
and it's so beautiful.
Yes, that's so true. I mean, without it, the whole city would change completely. It would be a different city without Central Park. There's no question about it. And the funny thing about what you've done is, we're talking about the vastness of the city in a kind of way. And yet in this book, the book we're talking about today, you have 50 authors who are looking at a much more concentrated view, perhaps only 20 or 30 square feet or less, out their window while perhaps they're writing. And I wonder, why is it that you believe that it's important to us, to them, what they see when they're writing? How are they informed? And how does it affect us? How does it evoke something in us, if indeed that's what your point was? Or is it just like the one guy who's just looking at his bathroom because a nice view would distract him? Is there something about the view that you believe imbues the writing with something?
Well, I do believe that we are, as we said, a few minutes ago, the most difficult thing is to realize where you are and the context where everything that happens in your life is set. So many times I postponed something that would have made me realize the kind of life that I live today or this past week, because I can do it next week. We were animals just a few generations ago, living only basically spending our time in nature. Since the last few generations, we've invented these incredible boxes out of which we perceive a portion of the world. It can't be, after drawing the entirety of Manhattan from the outside and then from Central Park, the moment I was about to leave my apartment where I'd worked for 7 years and I had done Manhattan Untrolled and Manhattan Within and two children's books, and I was ready to leave, and the view out my window could not be left behind, because I realized that I spent 7 years visually attached to that viewpoint, to that very specific perspective of the city, which was only mine. My neighbors saw something very similar, but absolutely not the same. And if I close my eyes and imagine that I wouldn't see it anymore, something immense would be lost. And so I quickly drew it on a large piece of paper. And then I realized, and then I started to ask, view out of a window is much more than just seeing what's out there. It's seeing why you are there in what's out there, the position in the sky, if you're higher up on the ground or just the first floor, whatever. But it's us specifically taking in that landscape. And that means our life, our decisions, and what brought us here and what could have brought us somewhere else. And so looking out a window, I discovered, and especially in a city as intricate and complex and full of life like New York, means to look at a city that is only yours, and that's your city, but also your life. And so I don't believe that writers are inspired by their window views. I never thought that. I believe that by seeing what they see, we understand a little bit more. you know, you may have read most of the books of an author you like, and then one day you see his face in a photograph or a painting. It's not that everything changes, but you add a piece of information about something, and I think this process is not a cause and effect kind of thing. It's not that people need something to do something else. It's that we live a life that is less meditative than it could be, and so stopping and looking out your window. Basically, the book invites everybody to stop, look out of his or her window.
And what
that means that you are in the place in the world, and you've made some choices, or somebody has made choices, maybe together with you, to be there. And I think it's not a bad thing to do.
And look, it's exactly what's happening to me now. I read the book, more than one of your books, and now I'm talking to you. By talking to you and getting to know you a little bit, it will change my entire perspective of your books. It's a very similar type thing. I would never have
the
opportunity.
Each other. That's why we offer very simply whatever we can in order to say, hey, I've noticed this, why don't you try? And I think sometimes pieces of whatever artistic expression, they're just means of sharing maybe an intuition that is not complete. My intuition about the city as a whole, because I don't know what everything is about New York, because you can draw, you know, the cloisters, seemingly medieval monastery, then you draw skyscrapers and every single building along the west side or east side. I don't know what I have drawn, but I tried to capture the essence of something that has truly meant a lot to me. And with the windows, it's the same. I've looked out my window, realized that for 7 years, I calculated that more or less I looked out 28 days, like 24-hour days, out of that hole. That must mean something to my the way I perceive my place in the world. And so when I started to ask people around, I realized that many hadn't even thought about it, but when they did, they realized, oh my God, I not only I have a view, but it means a lot to me, because it's not only a piece of glass, but it's a mirror back onto your place in the context of your life.
Yeah, it's like that one review said about the window, you know, it's looking in at you at the same time you're looking out through it. But
yeah.
But what's interesting to me is that all windows are framed. And as I said, a lot of what you draw is so expansive, and in your books, they fold out and fold out and fold out. And here, and also like when you left in 2004, you took pictures, but you found that the pictures were inadequate to describe what you were trying to describe. So that's why you're on brown paper drawing it, sketching it beautifully. But it's funny to me that it seems as if the frame is as important as the view itself, because without the frame, there's something. But you explain that to me. Explain what the frame does. If you
because without a frame, there is no view. Without the frame, there is only what is out there. I was never interested in what is out there. I was interested in what we see out there, which are two aspects of the same thing, but completely different in my mind. I'm more interested in what we see than what is there. And the frame is the pupil of the eye. It sets a very specific viewpoint in space that maybe never existed, has never existed before, I don't know, again, a few generations ago. Maybe it's even suspended up in the air. And 150 years ago, there were birds flying there and nothing else. And now you're there, your eye is suspended on the seventh floor of the apartment building on the Upper West Side of New York City. And from that suspended point, you see some other buildings that have been built by people in the last 100 or so years. This is a unique situation. If you reconstruct it with some kind of 3D computer modeling, it's a very unusual image that you would see. The drawings of the entirety of Manhattan, of the West Side, say, the 37 feet scroll that I've drawn, in reality, is not a view. It's a sequence of many, many views that, because I could lie by drawing, I could put them all together and give the impression that the whole is truly a whole and not a series of micro fragments of the way we perceive reality. And the view is not far from that, because the camera was, if I opened the window, I would have taken a photograph of a city, of an urban landscape, maybe nice, maybe okay, maybe beautiful, but just an urban landscape. If I took a photograph with the window closed, I would see basically mostly and only the frame, and the view would be hidden behind something else. The window view that we see instead, the brain, when we look out a window, the brain, like when you blink, erases somehow the frame, erases the pieces, the parts of the window frame that are in front of your eyes, like the horizontal bar. It's amazing how we are able to reconstruct the reality the way we expect it to be. And so drawing the window view meant that, first of all, you have to set up the context, which is that hole in the wall that is only there and nowhere else. And then behind, beyond, the drawings that I've done are a faithful reconstruction of the window views, but they take into account often the location of the tables where people mostly tend to sit, or the angle from which you see better a detail outside, or from which you don't see something you don't want to see. So it's still like a reconstruction, like nonfiction. The elements are all real, but the way you put them together has to somehow be a, I don't know, there has to be some kind of invention. And line drawings allow you to do that.
Yes, if you have the talent. It's interesting, though. Sometimes you look at a window that has a screen in it, and because the squares are so small, it's almost like you can pixelate the world. And you realize that all they are is pixels, but then at the same time, you generate the whole, and it's something else. And it's funny, my son last night was sending me YouTube videos of songs that I would listen to in 1968 and 1969, and he's telling me how wonderful they are, and he wished he lived in that time. And I responded and said, I wished I had lived in that time too, because when you're inside of it, you don't know what it's going to be later on. And it's again like what you said about your window. You couldn't take it with you, and you had it for 7 years, but you never really knew you had it. And
I wish I could now go back to, you know, the apartment where I grew up in Milan, and just to, you know, take the photographs and then come back and draw it again. Because if I close my eyes, I do remember many details, but I wish I could now put it all together into one piece.
The concept is fascinating because it brings up so many things in my head. It's like the Heisenberg principle of indeterminacy. It's like by looking at something, we change it. If it isn't observed, it's not either not there or it's something different. But once you observe it, the wave function collapses, and there it is. And
that's an interesting comparison. I never thought about it, but I do agree. In fact, for example, one of the writers, when we were still working on the New York Times series, she didn't want to participate at first, because the first the few installments before were the first was Harun Pamuk, with his astonishing view, etc. And she was happy about being asked to take part in the series, but she said, I don't have a view. She thought that she didn't have that thing, and I knew what she was talking about, but I also knew that she didn't know what she was talking about, because having a view doesn't mean to have a good-looking, photogenic view. That is not a view. That is a painting. That is a nice something that doesn't add to the inner look or understanding of the person, to the mirror effect that we were talking about. So we went ahead and did the collaboration. And as soon as she saw the drawing, she saw the very same thing but drawn, and she said, "Oh my God, I do have a view. I never thought I did, and thank you for showing it to me." Because she hadn't been able to take that step as you were saying earlier when we were talking, that step back and looking at the very same thing with a little bit of distance. And it was a wonderful collaboration. It was Marina Endicott's view. And she loved the view. One of the people in the city out my window actually used to keep the curtains on. Then after I drew the window view, he saw that it was actually an interesting view. So he opened it, you know, because you see other buildings, etc. And it's funny how truly difficult it is to see and understand your surroundings. Something that happened because of the series, and something that I'm hoping to bring forward and develop even more, have been projects by school children, mostly in middle school, who have been asked to do exactly the same, you know, go home, draw your window view, and write a description, and then we put it together, and they sent it to me. And because the views can more or less be divided into, you know, active views and passive views. The active views are like Orhan Pamuk's, you know, I've been here, I chose to be here, this is my world, it inspires me, and this is my life.
But yes,
passive
but
view is often of someone who has not chosen.
Yes, but the difference is, and this entranced me, is that with Orhan, you have, as he says, he has Asia on his left side, he has the Bosphorus in the middle, and the opening to the Sea of Marmara, as well as the islands he's been going to for 58 years, and to the right is the entrance to the Golden Horn, and the part of the city that Istanbul residents refer to as the Old Town. His view is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's absolutely phenomenal. And then he writes, you know, my name is Red, and he doesn't even realize that he's looking at what he's writing about. But that's what originally, and that's the first one. And I thought, okay, this book is going to be about these phenomenal views of viewing the history of what you're writing about. These, you know, you're looking out at three different places that fought with each other, that lived with each other. And then it changes. And at first I was disappointed. And then I realized it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Absolutely. It doesn't. Actually, the Pamuk was a wonderful way to begin, but it set the standard so high, and it was contrary to what my idea of views was always, which was exactly the opposite. Meaning, the more unknown, intricate, or apparently meaningless is the view, the more the story behind it can be told and found. And that's the quintessential active view. You know, I see the world from here. This is the best place I can possibly be. But imagine a child who has not chosen, A, to be born, and B, to be in that very place. He may be lucky with a beautiful view or not, but the way he draws and the way he will describe his view is incredibly telling of many more things. And that's the funny consequence of the project that would be great to continue to explore.
And that's why it's so nice that you do the children's books that you do, because it touches on that. And it's funny, because when my 3-year-old daughter drew a picture out of our window, it didn't look anything like it. But then again, I looked at it again, it looked exactly like it.
And
it,
you see, fantastic, yeah.
It didn't look like it at all, but I knew what it was, and it had actually more in it than the view did. It's almost as if you've written some type of, I don't know how to say it, but it's almost as if it's almost a psychological study rather than a visual study.
I agree. I've done workshops in classes, like a 2-hour workshop. There's no time to do but the view out of the window from in the class. And sometimes, you know, 20 kids, they all do the same 2 window views in the class, and all of the drawings look different. They all look incredibly different, but then you look, as you said, and you find all of the details that you have missed, all the things that you haven't seen, and you can put them together, and you realize how cities are perceived by children. And we need, I think, projects like window views drawn only by kids between, say, 9 and 12, or 6 and 11, I don't know, but in order to see how the places that we have designed, that we think that they are for everybody, are truly taken in by people who do not choose their views and the place they live, etc. And then with the description and the drawing that tells you exactly what their eyes caught, we may be able to understand, you know, what we have done, how we have put together these masses of buildings and how they are perceived. And I'm happy to hear about your daughter's drawing, because that's exactly what happens when I do these little workshops. Or
yes, and I can see the drawing right now in my head, and I always will be able to, no matter how old I get. And it's the funny thing is that you don't have a genre. You're not fiction, nonfiction. It's not a mystery, a thriller, a science fiction novel. It's not magical realism. It's not any of those things, and I don't know what it is, but I know that there's a response I have to it. And it's like I was saying before about people not looking up. You say to someone, did you see the moon last night? Well, no, they didn't, because they didn't look up. And then I feel like kind of sad about your book, because I think, how many times have I missed? Like when my son said that about the music, did I miss it? It's almost like you have to be a bodhisattva and live in every moment in order to achieve what you did in this book. Almost.
No, then that's you're very nice, and but that's almost too much. I think it's the opposite of genre. I think in the case of kids, for example, I realize that the results are always amazing, because by limiting the boundaries of creativity, you're actually expressing much more creativity by saying, you know, don't worry. Just draw the frame and just draw what you see out of your window. Kids are relaxing, and they are not thinking of what kind of drawing do I have to do, what kind of a piece of art. The word art disappears. The word, all of the things that are related to the performance of the artist go away. Just tell me what you see, and maybe write what you see. And I think that we should... maybe pursue, instead of art or genre, I think that poetry is hidden in all of these
that's true.
Daily areas.
That's true. It's visual poetry. That's what it is.
And that would be too much for me, but for the kids, definitely. What the kids do is indeed the visual poetry, because they are fresh and unaware. I'm careful about my lines, so I'm careful about the seeming precision of what I do, so that I don't know. And but it is fun. I like it.
I just thought of something. You know the American expression, you can't see the forest for the trees?
Yeah.
Your book is the opposite. You can't see the trees for the forest. So you let people see the trees, because they're too busy generally walking along looking at the forest.
Maybe. So we found a kind of a long name for a genre.
yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Well,
that works for me.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you. I wish I could. I wanted to go through other books, but we don't have the time. But it was a pleasure talking to you about this book. I really enjoyed it. And as I said, we have our independent bookstore, and it's such a nice book to look at that people just come in and they almost have to pick it up. It's just something about it that you and I've watched it. I've watched them do that. And
that's wonderful.
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful both ways, for you, for us. And I really thank you for the work you've done and for joining us here today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking to you.
Well, that was Matteo Pericoli, who wrote Windows on the World, a wonderful book that's incredibly visual, as are all of his books. And as I said, he wrote one. Well, no, he did the mural, I think, at Kennedy, the International Terminal, and it's 396 feet long. And he's an incredible architect and draftsman. And you can buy that book and several other books, but you have to fold out. He's reduced it to like 20 feet, but you still have to fold out the whole thing. But it's well worth the effort. In any event, as always, an interesting author and an interesting book. And we'll be next week when we speak to the acclaimed author, Ned Bowman, who's going to discuss his latest work, Glow. For a complete schedule of all of our past broadcasts and what's upcoming, you can visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com, WCHE 1520, or simply download our podcast at iTunes or Podomatic, or on our YouTube channel. The funny thing about iTunes is, however we got lucky, we did. And if you go to iTunes, you don't even have to go to podcasts. Just in the search box, type the Avid Reader. You'll come up with all 200 of our interviews. Or, like with Matteo, since he has an unusual name, if you just type Matteo Pericoli, you will come up with our podcast. There may be some other ones as well, but generally ours pops up first. So you can type Windows on the World, Matteo Pericoli. And like next week after that, you can type Ned Bowman or the word glow. And we usually are, maybe we get scooped by Terry Gross, but generally we're one of the first. And that's increased over the years as the show has gotten more popular and authors seem to like us. So as always, thank you for joining us today. And we hope that you'll be back next week when we interview Ned Bowman regarding his work, Glow.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.